Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very pleased to have as my guest Amitav Ghosh. He is the author, most recently, of Sea of Poppies. Sea of Poppies is going to be the first book of a trilogy called the Ibis Trilogy. And I think, really, that it's an extraordinary book. Many of the people I've spoken to did not know, as I did not know, that the opium that was the subject of the Opium Wars was grown in India, and it was the British colonialization of India that was growing and essentially stealing this crop to capture and possess the Chinese. What we see in this new novel, Sea of Poppies, is a whole world of international relations as reflected in all of the languages of the cultures that are involved in this navigation, this trade. It includes, because the British have been forbidden to have slaves, well, we can have coolies now, can't we? And who are the coolies? Well, they're being brought from Mauritius or to Mauritius or from China to India. A whole new way of organizing, essentially, the slave trade and the addiction trade, the dependency trade, and all of it with many languages brought about by trade and navigation that enter the Indian language and enter the English language and eventually even appear in the OED. And in a certain way, this book is a book about the travel of emigrant languages, how language travels the globe. It's in that way a rare and extraordinary work to be reading a book that really is at one and the same time a page-turner and an astrological reading of the travel of language as if language were the stars of fate and where they move to is the future of a global colonization, a imperialism that is going to fall and create the modern world. And novels used to be published in three volumes. Many of Dickens's eventually were, after their initial serialization, and these were called triple-deckers. How far in time will this trilogy take us?
To be honest, Michael, I can't even really say, because, I thought I would get through several years in this, and I got through 8 months. this book really just covers a period of 8 months in the year 1838. But, it's not even a sort of, it's not even something that I'm really thinking about, because as I see it, I'm going to be living with these characters for a long, long time. And, I want to follow them. I want to follow their children, their grandchildren, their descendants, as far as I can.
Now, this book, though, does give us certain indications of what the future holds. In the back of the book, there's what's called the Ibis Chrestomathy, and it is a volume, it's based on many volumes of lexicography that tell us how certain Indian words like pajamas have entered the English language and vice versa. There's a constant play of language, and this Chrestomathy is written by, and here are the great greats, the great, 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 great grandchild of the Raja whose fortunes are scuttled in this first book.
Yes, absolutely. it was something which I was doing, as I was writing this book, because because of my life circumstances, it's been my great blessing that I know many languages, and these languages are in my head, and they're sort of clashing, and they're all in there. And I think the more I've worked with these languages, the more I've come to realize that you can't really even, in any useful way, draw boundaries always between languages, because there's such a sort of process of cross-fertilization, such a process of borrowing and exchange. So, in that way, I'm kind of obsessed with words, and most of all with unusual words. This is not unusual, of course, in a writer. Many of us are obsessed with these words. But when you start looking at the genealogies of these words, that's what's really interesting, because there's so much, like my characters, they sort of pass, they go from, one home to another, and they're always in this process of migration. And one of my characters, who is in fact a person who's very interested in language, actually began in my own head. He began to write this Christomathy, which was, in the 19th century, many linguists and writers wrote Christomathies, but it's kind of, which actually just means a key to language. But it's, it sort of fell out of fashion in the 20th century, but I always thought it was a wonderful thing to do.
Now, when you began, I've read many of your books, and for our listeners, I want to put you with your work. We talked on the show about The Glass Palace, and your last book was The Hungry Tide, but Circle of Reason, The Calcutta Chromosome, you began as a different kind of writer, influenced by a postmodern kind of novel. Now, I think, to my heart's delight, these are books for readers really to live in. They're very commodious, although we will be moving from very interesting and luxurious settings in this book by the end to the quarters for people who've sold themselves as indentured servants or who are about to be sold, and we're going to move into narrower and narrower quarters. But this is a book that you follow for the fate of its characters. And, I want the second volume right now because there are so many of them whose futures I desire to know. I mean, you are turning another kind of addiction to profit in this novel. It's not opium, but the hunger for storytelling, which is in many ways a subject of this novel as well. What brought you, by what process did you go from a more theoretical fiction to this reader-friendly fiction?
I think it's just life, really. I'm 52 now, and I think it's just the process of living, of bringing up children, of, growing into middle age with with people you've known for a very long time. And, I have friends. Many of my closest friends have been friends of mine for 30 years. Their children are my children's friends. And in that sense, I feel, when I started writing this book, I really felt that, I'm at a stage in my life when I know about things, I've lived in very poor communities in many parts of the world. I've seen the struggles, I've seen the difficulties. And I've also I've been privileged to know extremely successful people. And I want to be able to put it all together. I want to be able to put together everything that I've seen and intuited and known about the world and how it goes. And I want, most of all, to be able to recreate, you know, something which I find very precious in my life, which are these long, long connections, you know, these old lingering loyalties of 30 years, 40 years, you know.
And here in this book, we begin with the opium trade. Now, just to give the listener a sense of its intricacy, how is opium grown and produced?
Well, you know, opium, of course, is a substance that has been known to man since the infancy of mankind, and it's really a miraculous and magical substance. I mean, just in terms of medicines, it's a remarkable thing. But I think historically in India, opium was grown by poppies were grown by farmers in very small quantities. You know, they just produced a little bit because it's a very labor-intensive crop. When the British started trying to create a market for opium in China, what they did was that they very rapidly expanded the acreage of opium in northern India. They declared the opium trade a monopoly of the British East India Company. And within a decade or two, they increased the acreage of opium tenfold, you know.
Creating a famine in turn because people, villages are not growing the food that they...
I don't know if I would go that far. You know, one of the strange things about this is that there hasn't been the research, you know. It's not there. I mean, very little research actually exists on the, you know, on the. We have some research on the trade, but very little research on its social impact and what actually, the ways in which it impacted the communities. Looking between the lines, it seems to me that, you know, the sudden introduction of seasonal monoculture must have severely disrupted the peasant cycle, you know, the cycles of cultivation, because this becomes the area from which hundreds of thousands of people begin to migrate. You know, this is an area which has historically been a very, very rich part of India. And during this period, it just descended into poverty from which it has never emerged. You know, so what happened is that what happens is that, you know, opium is grown on farms under contract to this British-run factory. There are two or three major factories, and the factory's agents fan out into the countryside, and they force often these loans upon the farmers, so that they can so that they have to plant the opium, and then they can only sell it to the factory, and they sell it at, you know, really I mean, cutthroat prices. I mean, this substance, which the East India Company merchants will then sell in China for a king's ransom, you know, is the poor farmers get almost nothing out of it. But in fact, what was really interesting to me, as you know, I've always had this sort of great interest in the ways in which people work and the ways in which they make things. And I found, quite by chance, this marvelous description of the opium factory of Ghazipur, written by a man called J.W.S. MacPherson, who was actually the superintendent of the Ghazipur opium factory. He wrote this little pamphlet in 1860. I mean, it was published in 1860. And he wrote it as a kind of Baedeker. His idea was to attract British tourists to go and visit the opium factory of Ghazipur. So there's a detailed description, you know. But apart from that, we possess these wonderful lithographs of these opium factories. Really marvelous lithographs. I mean, where they look like, you know, the factories. So we have a very, very rich visual record.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Amitav Ghosh, author most recently of Sea of Poppies, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Amitav Ghosh about his novel, Sea of Poppies. Now, when I talk about the return of the historical, the naturalist, the realist, the family novel here. I think, in part, I'm talking about the possibility in your writing of restoring to history via fiction something that would be otherwise, in a sense, lost to history, that these books provide a very different function now, that this is an act, in a sense, of restoration, yes, and conservation.
That's very true, Michael. I mean, you know, it's an extraordinary thing that this history of, say, opium in India was unknown. I released the book in India 6 months ago, and it was people were astonished to learn, about the cultivation of opium. It's a very powerfully repressed memory, you know. And even historians really don't know about it. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing. I mean, here was this substance, this commodity, which was really providing one-fifth of the revenues of the British Raj. I mean, it was what permitted the colonial government to sustain itself. It was basically opium. But, all of that has been so powerfully excised from memory that people have forgotten that. But, you know, that was just one aspect of it. The other aspect of it, which was, to me, just as compelling and just as exciting, was the rediscovery of the Asian nautical world, you know. And that was something which completely sort of obsessed me. And, again, this was another aspect of our experience, which is now slowly being recovered, but which has never had an imaginative representation, you know. And yet, in the 19th century, even in the 18th century and the 17th century, if you actually look at crew manifests, and it's really remarkable how many of the sailors, even on Western ships, were actually Asians, you know. And the one person who does faithfully represent that, I think, is actually Herman Melville. So in many ways, you know, my book is both something that was inspired by Melville, but also it's a tribute to Melville, you know, because I really do think that Melville is the very greatest American writer. I mean, really America's Shakespeare in a way. And one of the really remarkable things about him is that he was a very good observer. He had this incredible curiosity about the world, you know.
Well, you'll pardon me, but I found, first of all, much of the book extraordinarily funny. Now, I know that people who are hearing the tone of my questions are thinking, the horrors of imperialism, the human trait. But in fact, it's not an angry book. First of all, why not?
Well, you know, the thing is, you know, what is this book about? It's about, all sorts of horrible things. I mean, intoxication, opium addiction, and people being, being taken into bondage and taken across the sea. So, but, you know, the extraordinary thing about it is that I think it was two things. One is that at a certain point, I knew that if I didn't laugh, I would never be able to finish this book. And the other thing is that, you know, it was the spirit of these people, the characters I was writing about, that really imbued itself into me, you know, because, you know, one of the things that we do see from the sort of actual existing record is that the indentured workers, this is true of Chinese indentured workers and Indian indentured workers, when they were being taken away, many observers comment on how much they sang. They sang, they had, you know, they kept themselves going. And I think there is something about that spirit. There's something about that spirit of resilience, you know, that sort of transcendence of that circumstance, which really infected me too. And I've also been in the world long enough now to know that it's really a kind of sentimentality to think that people who are in difficult circumstances are always gloomy. They're not, you know. I mean, I spent a long time in parts of India where people live in incredibly difficult circumstances, and they've often been the people who laugh the most, which is not to sentimentalize poverty and difficulty, you know, but it's just one aspect of the human condition, one of the paradoxical things that makes life possible.
Well, it's also that as the book goes on, you know, there is the story of life, but there's also the design of a novel. And the design of a novel is different from its content. And we're watching one group of people after another. We're moving amongst them. The chapters artfully arrange their stories as in a solitaire deck. You feel that, well, here's the next group. Here's the next. Oh, there they are again. What a pleasure. And gradually, we come to grasp that they're all heading toward one place, the boat, the Ibis, which is going to take some of them to Mauritius.
Yes.
And that boat wildly becomes like the vast bedroom of a farcical novel, because suddenly we're below boards. There's a prisoner whose wall enclosure gives him access to a young woman who has seen him before. There are all kinds of sudden possibilities that have more to do, perhaps, with the genius of high comedy than with the architecture of a slaving vessel. This seems to me to be part of the ingenuity of this novel that allows us to read with pleasure material that might make us sick with horror.
It's just a fact that if you have, I mean, if you think of a 19th century sailing ship, you know, within a sort of a 100-foot long vessel, everyone is squeezed together, you know. And it's one of the aspects of nautical fiction, which to me is incredibly compelling. I mean, I'm sure you've read William Golding's Rites of Passage. You'll remember how extraordinary it is. Or for that matter, Matthew Neal's English Passengers, you know, where, you know, once you push together a lot of people into a circumstance, you know, it can't be written in a monotone, because that's not what it is. It's not all just tragedy and so on. I mean, it's also, people do, funny things happen. You know, all sorts of weird and bizarre things happen.
But also the writer's ingenuity is at play as well.
Thank you.
I mean, you're trying to allow us only gradually to see that these characters are all coming together on their ship. I mean, many of these involve hairpin surprises and secrets about brothers and sisters, about genealogy, even about skin color, about the history of American mulattoes, about the extraordinary way, I mean, it's done brilliantly, that we see a black man dressed by a lascar to be able to go to a ceremonial dinner and pass himself off, what, as a lord.
Well, in effect, he's mistaken for a lord, yes. But look, I mean, you know, it's such an interesting thing. I mean, I really have never believed in this idea of a singular identity for anybody, because I know that in my own life, I switch personae often, you know. I mean, the way that I'm speaking with you now is not how I would speak, you know, in India with my friends. I mean, one's accent changes, one's registers change. And it's so interesting to see, for example, that Hillary Clinton does that as well. I mean, you know, she sometimes speaks in a southern accent and sometimes in sort of like a high northern, and Barack Obama does the same as well. You know, this is something that really interests me, you know, the switching of codes and the ways in which people become malleable, you know, within circumstances, and the ways in which they adapt themselves.
I'm glad you brought that up, because it leads me to my final question. There's a woman here, as is natural in a book that's going to involve poppies. Of course, there's a botanist, and he has a daughter. The daughter has been brought up with virtually an Indian brother. They've been raised together. They've been best friends. And on shipboard, she discovers as she moves from group to group that her nature is chameleonic and that change. All of these characters are learning that the ability to transvest and disguise themselves. One of them, perhaps not even willed, is discovering, emerging in himself, a woman who had been a priestess. And he is beginning to wear dresses and allow his bosoms to emerge. We're kind of grateful because he's been such a horrible, mean, foolish character before that even though his spirituality is somewhat foolish as well, he's learning, he says, to be maternal. All these characters are learning transformation, and it seems as if that may be one of the major themes of the trilogy. Can you tell me?
Yes, that's absolutely the case. Rilke says somewhere that, you know, life is lived in transformation. And, you know, that's something I very profoundly believe, you know, that it's that process of reinvention, that process of change, which interests me personally, but which is also in some way the story of movement, you know, the story of travel, the story of migration. I mean, if you think back to your ancestor who first came to America, the ship becomes the place where they invent themselves.
I've been speaking with Amitav Ghosh, author most recently of Sea of Poppies. Well, it's a transfixing book, and, you know, for those of us who like to plan vast itineraries in our reading lives, to know that there'll be two more in this Ibis trilogy is exciting indeed.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you very much. And it's such a pleasure to be here, and thank you very much for having me.
The publisher is Farrah Straus and Giroux. You can read an excerpt from Sea of Poppies at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.